Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening, this is your host Dan Zupansky for the program True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. He dissolved the bodies of some of his victims in acid and poured them down the sewer. He hung grisly souvenirs on nails in his junkyard. Charles Caniglia was a stone-cold killer who fell in with the bloodthirsty John Gotti crew. As the infamous crime family rose to power with their murderous trail of sex, jealousy, greed, and revenge, Caniglia rose with them. This is the horrifying story of a misfit who fit perfectly into the New York Mafia. In a harrowing journey inside a ruthless criminal underworld, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Anthony M. DiStefano chronicles one man's life in a world of depraved acts of violence and the horrors that went with being a member of the Gambino family. The book featured this evening is Mob Killer, with my special guest, journalist and author Anthony M. DiStefano. Thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, and welcome back to the program, Anthony DiStefano.
Thank you very much for having me again.
Thank you very much. It's going to be a very interesting program. The inside scoop on the most infamous mafioso characters, and very, very interesting book. I got to congratulate you again for doing it once
Thank
again.
Thank you very much.
Okay, first off, just for people that might not know you, maybe you can tell us how you really came to do this story and why you decided to write about this particular case. What brought you to this story?
Well, I had been covering the federal courts for one of the newspaper in New York, and Charlie Caniglia's trial was one that came up into my area. And I covered the trial, and let me tell you, it was an eye-opener in many ways. Of course, my publisher was interested in the character after having seen the book on Joe Messina that I had written,
right,
and asked me to do it. And I was a little unclear or uncertain in the beginning because his life spanned 30 years in the crime family, and it was, here and there and everywhere. But finally, a story emerged, particularly through the trial transcript that I spent a Christmas vacation reading. And it came together slowly but surely over time.
Right. Now, tell us first, the obviously Charles Caniglia is the main character in this story, but there is so much of a supporting cast here that really are very, very important to the story. So no money really is the real focus, because it's such a tangled web and interconnected between all these characters. So maybe first tell us about Charles and John Caniglia, and tell us what kind of characters both of these people are, because it's very important to the story. And you can maybe even include another important figure in this, and that's Charles and John's mother, Jeannie.
Right. Well, John Caniglia, some aficionados of mob history may recall, was one of the chief confederates of the late John Gotti. And John was not that much older than his brother Charles, but he was certainly the better place kind of guy, the more charismatic character, and the person who, he had the trappings of a regular life, so to speak. He married, had a number of kids, and, had a house in Howard Beach where a lot of the guys who were in the crime families seem to go, would gravitate right towards. And Charlie was kind of the misfit. He was the guy who had drinking problems, drug problems, relationship problems. He would, he was volatile. He was moody. He, if he was in a bad mood, watch out. kind of character. He, you know, everybody sort of, I guess, you know, a ne'er-do-well brother or uncle. You know, you might be able to compare him to that. And, well, of course, with John Corniglia being tight with the Gotti crew out of Ozone Park, Charlie was kind of a tag-along guy. You know, he would help his brother. He would associate with a lot of the crime family guys. And gradually, you know, got to be reliable because he would do certain pieces of work. You know, he was a guy they could make a fallback upon if they needed somebody to be killed. And that's
right.
What the evidence in the case showed. And the family was, you know, his family, his regular family, was not much of a, you know, nothing outstanding. I mean, the mother, Jenny, was a seamstress. The father, I think, was a used car salesman, Bill. He sort of died, I think, sometime maybe in the 1970s or early 80s. And Jenny became the person Charlie, and to some extent his brother John, focused on because maybe it was guilt. Maybe they felt like they were giving her so much grief with all their problems that,
right,
you know, they had to take care of her. And they did. And Charlie, when his brother got sentenced to 50 years on a drug case, it was Charlie who was the one who was at home taking care of Mom. And as she progressed through the years and became more, enfeebled, he was the one, you know, she had to rely upon. So that was kind of a redeeming facet of Charles, at least to some people's mind, that he really did take care of his mother. And another thing which people point out is that he did like little kids. You know, he was very sort of paternal and, you know, like toddlers, particularly.
Right.
Like a gregarious uncle towards him. He never had any kids of his own. He never married, although he had a number of girlfriends. But, you know, in his life, when him being the character he was, volatile, you know, moody drinker and drug user, you know, these relationships were not destined for anything great. So whatever relationship he did have, you know, they sort of didn't go very far. And I think he did want to marry one of the women, but you know, she didn't want to have anything to do with it in the end. It just wasn't going to work. He was kind of a broken valise kind of guy, you know, towards the end of his life.
Right. Now, just for the audience, I thought it was very interesting, and I've heard this before, but it was reinforced because it's very important to the story, is that when you talked about Charles being characterized by being a drunk and volatile and unreliable and ends up, he's not a big earner, really, and not much of a mobster in comparison to his brother, we'll say. At least they're in two
right.
different leagues. Now, explain for us, for the audience, how much being a drug user and even the big rule that seems to be overlooked, but how important it is to the story about drugs itself. Tell us about the role of drugs if you're a drug user and if you deal drugs, what's the mafia's viewpoint on this?
Well, you know, the traditional rule was that the mob wasn't supposed to deal in drugs, you know, certainly back in the old days. But everybody knows, you know, that that rule was readily ignored, and it's readily ignored today. And Charles was involved in a marijuana operation, so the evidence showed. He would use drugs himself. He would drink. And, you know, even though the big bosses, and certainly the old legendary bosses like Carlo Gambino or, you know, Tommy Lucchese, and to some extent Messino, didn't like drugs or people to deal with them, you know, it was a fact of life in the mob. And it's a fact of life today. A lot of the big earners in the mob were into drugs. In fact, Vito Genovese himself got convicted in a drug case and sent away ultimately. So that's a myth. These guys did use. You'd be surprised at how many of the old mob guys were using drugs, particularly in the Bonanno crime family. There are a number of guys who got hooked on cocaine. One of the late John Gotti's guys, Anthony Rampino, had a problem with heroin, which affected him all of his life. Charles had a problem with drug use. He also had a bigger problem, it seems, with alcohol.
Right.
Normally, this could get you killed because, you know, you would be seen as an unreliable guy or somebody who would get into trouble and possibly flip and become a government witness, or just talk too much.
Sure.
Or not do very well in any kind of assignment you had. And Charles had all of these problems. But I think because his brother was John, and I think because he had, through that channel anyway, an in with John, the late John Gotti, Charlie got a pass. You know, he could have been killed if he was anybody else, I think, for the way he abused drugs and the way he was sort of a flake. Now, I'm not saying he didn't kill people. The evidence showed that he did. But, you know, he did it in a sort of a haphazard kind of way. And his volatility in confrontation with people brought heat onto the crime family. And, you know, he became risky. But he had a good in, and he was able to survive. And not many people can do that.
Now, let's talk. We won't get too far ahead. I think we can save this for a little bit later, as you do in the book. But tell us who Kevin McMahon is. At first, he's a homeless Howard Beach person that John and Charles meet and befriend. And he's very important to the story, obviously. Tell us how it came to be that Kevin McMahon was taken in by John and Charles Carnegie and the Carnegie family.
Kevin McMahon was basically a street urchin. He, you know, in Dickens' time, he would have fallen in with Fagin's crew probably.
Sure.
But here in Howard Beach, Kevin's parents, mother and father, I think, had drug issues. He was living with his grandmother. But when he started messing around stealing cars, the grandmother threw him out. So where did he go? He lived in the cabana, the sort of pool house that John Carniglia had in his backyard. You know, usually it was warm months he could live there. And they discovered him there, and, you know, they kind of, I guess, took pity on him and took him into their fold, as it were. He became part of the family. He wasn't adopted in a real sense, but he became like an unofficial family member. But so tight he was with the Carniglias that, you know, he would go on vacations with them. They came to his wedding. You know, they'd see about jobs for him. He became an adjunct to their blood family. And, of course, with John and Charles being into the crime family, it didn't take much for Kevin to become like a loyal sort of servant. At first, you know, to John, and then when John got jailed with Charlie. And Charlie was the guy he palled around with. And actually, Kevin was kind of a stabilizing influence on Charles because the mobsters wanted Kevin to keep an eye out on Charlie because, you know, once he started drinking or did drugs or whatever, he needed somebody to sort of tamper him down and, you know, keep a handle on him, to watch over him. And that was Kevin's role. But by being so close to Charlie, Kevin saw a lot. He heard a lot. And in some cases, he did things that put him into contact with the criminal ventures. One of them was the assassination of Louis De Bono, who angered John Gotti Sr. by not coming to a meeting when he was called. So Kevin was kind of he wasn't a shooter or anything, but he was involved in procuring the car, and I think even driving to the ultimate assassination scene. So Kevin, you know, by not doing anything too heavily criminal, he implicated himself in some bad things by being close to Charles. So when Kevin got into problems, the feds were able to target him. And once Kevin got targeted, you know, it was a short time before, you know, they were able to make a cooperating witness out of him.
Okay, before we get into that, let's try to draw for our audience the lines between this Gambino family and John Gotti so that everyone's clear. We've spoken already about John Gotti receiving an extensive sentence, and then there's, of course, Gotti Jr.,
right.
John Jr., who effectively takes over the crew or takes over the work of his father, but some people are not so happy about that and are not not so willing
to
go along with that.
John Gotti Sr., as I think you're well aware, was the head of the family, and he got there by this this coup with the assassination of Paul Castellano,
right.
And I think it was late 1985. Gotti, of course, was the ascendant power. John Carniglia was under John Gotti Sr., and by association, Charlie was part of that orbit, as it were. When John Gotti Sr. was convicted and sent away, the family went into a state of flux, and there were a number of people running it, a sort of an acting committee, if you will, and one of them was Gotti's son, John, who I call John Jr. Some people weren't happy with that. They thought it was just pure nepotism, and even Charlie was not happy with that. But after a while, Charlie had to be aligned with somebody, and he became, the evidence showed in the case, under the wing of John Gotti Jr. So he was part of John Jr.'s world, at least for a time. And that's how this all lines up. You had Sr., the top dog, until he goes away, and then his son, Jr., at least for a short period anyway, was running some things, and then ultimately the captain of Charlie. And Charlie, for a while anyway, was under Junior. That's how that breaks out.
Now, why? Tell us about Vincent and Peter Gotti, and why, and what were their roles, and why were they not able to take control of this family?
Well, you know, Peter, John Gotti Senior's brother, had a lot of problems of his own, and he really wasn't viewed by many of the other people in the crime family as really the guy with the ability to lead the family. He could take the payoffs or money or whatever, but he didn't impress a lot of people as being that organizationally smart.
Right.
But Peter ultimately, I think because of just that there were so few people left through indictments and murders or whatever, ultimately did take over as head of the family. And in fact, law enforcement now carries him officially, and we've seen this in a number of trials, as the head of the Gambino crime family, at least a name.
Right.
But he's in jail for life, so it's really sort of a hollow position. There's really nothing
sure.
to do. There was a brother, Vincent, a little lesser-known brother, who had, it seemed, his own drug problems, really wasn't thought about very well on the street, and he got convicted in the same case, essentially, with Charles. Ultimately, Charles was undoing. So you had Vincent Gotti sent away. You had Peter Gotti sent away. John Gotti Sr., dead, and, of course, jailed and died in prison. John Gotti Jr., at least for a time, up until maybe 1999, was involved in the crime family. I mean, he's more or less admitted that in his own federal trials. But as you probably well aware, you know, he had four mistrials on a federal case, and
right.
He claims he's out of the crime business and has been for quite some period.
Sure. Now, let's another fascinating thing I think you mentioned in the book, too, that a lot of people are very aware of this story, maybe not knowing the sort of victim's name, but they know of the story where John Gotti's youngest son, Frankie, is accidentally killed by a man named John Favera. And tell us about that whole story, because, of course, it's very important to what
yeah,
happened
later. Yeah, it's one
later.
Of the great legends of mob lore. You know, in a nutshell, little Frankie Gotti, I think he was 12 or 13 at the time, was on a motorbike and in the Howard Beach area, and he got hit, run over by a car driven by John Favaro, who happened to be a neighbor of the Gotti family.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great hue and cry, and it was, of course, a great tragedy for the family. And it didn't, of course, not only did it not sit well with John Gotti and his own family, but John Favara, it seemed, sort of, at least from some of the histories, aggravated the family by really not showing much contrition.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is, of course, open to some debate. But ultimately, the bad blood persisted, and it really sent a lot of John Gotti himself into depression, and it seemed perhaps some anger. So ultimately, John Favara disappeared. And it seems as though if John Gotti Sr. didn't order his death, people close to him did take care of John Favara. He disappeared. A lot of speculation as to what happened to that hapless sort of driver of the vehicle. You know, there was speculation that his body was dumped at sea in some concrete. There was talk that it was chopped up and put in a car and then pressed into some, you know, metal yard or something like that. In Charlie's case, witnesses came forward to say that based on what Charles told them, Charles was given the task of dissolving the body. And it was actually Angelo Ruggiero, the late Angelo Ruggiero, who gave him the task of dissolving John Favara's body. Charlie at first sort of screwed it up. He didn't use the right acid, according to what the witnesses said in the case. Ultimately, he did get it right, the witnesses said, and then took some of the bones of John Favara to show that he could do the job. He took some of the bones to the diner where Angelo Ruggiero was having soup and dropped some of the bones into his soup bowl. You know, said, listen, I was able to take care of it. That's what the witnesses told us. That's what they told the government. That came out at trial, came out in the context of the case and filings by the government. And it was really rather amazing story when it first surfaced, you know, because that was always the mystery. What happened to John Favara? And although we don't know for sure who killed him, you know, it's likely that John Gotti Sr. Had a role in this and got the ball rolling. Angelo Ruggiero, it seemed, the late Angelo Ruggiero, was involved. Everybody involved is dead, more or less, in the disappearance of John Favara. But it seems that Charlie was tasked with getting rid of the body. And that is the story that came back through various government court documents that we saw filed in the case and some witnesses.
Now, there's quite a few more characters, and we'll go through them because they become very important at the trial and of course, into Charles Carnegie and all the other mafioso members' lives. Can you tell us about Peter Zaccario and his relationship with Charles? And he'd known him for almost 40 years, he had said.
That's true.
By the time he went to trial. So tell us about the relationship between Peter Zaccario and Charles and what kind of business.
Peter Zaccario was another mob wannabe who was sort of born to, I guess, a family that had some mobsters attached to it. He became enamored very early in life with the mob life. He lived in Brooklyn, grew up in Brooklyn. And, you know, he was a guy who was a knockabout kind of guy. He was aspiring to be a mobster. And he, of course, he traveled around East New York and Ozone Park and Howard Beach in a certain time period in New York. You know, you're going to run into John Carniglia and Charlie Carniglia. And it was Charles and Peter Zaccario became pretty good friends. They palled around a lot. They did marijuana business a lot. Peter Zaccario, he said that he brought stolen cars to Charlie in his junkyard. So there was a connection that started, and it seemed pretty substantial for a number of years. And, of course, they got doing crimes together, you know, committing crimes together, hanging out. And it was through that association that Peter got to know a lot about Charles. So when things started to happen, when things started to go bad for Peter, Peter, of course, turned on Charles and became a government witness. So you have Kevin McMahon as a government witness, and you have Peter Zaccario. Zaccario, the funny thing about Zaccario is when he had the opportunity to join the mob, he was offered to be a made member, so he says.
Right.
He turned it down. He turned it down because it just seemed like too much of a hassle. He didn't want to get involved in the politics. He was not that happy with John Gotti, you know, Sr., because, you know, John Gotti Sr. was the celebrity, and this is a secret society. You know, what are you doing being a celebrity? You know, there seemed to be different rules for the underlings, the sort of peasants of the family, and guys like, you know, Gotti, who was the boss. So he was off that. He didn't like that kind of existence. He'd rather be his own man you know, associate with the mob and not be a member and not have to deal with the politics. Strange guy. Saw him testify a number of times, right out of, you know, the central casting look, very sort of terse, wise guy answers like yes and no. And, you know, he had a voice that would, somebody you wouldn't want to meet in a dark alley, you know, with a gun in his hand, you know, because you knew that was going to be it. The last thing you'd hear him say were his words. It was really, it was quite amazing to watch him. You know, he was one of these dyed-in-the-wool gangsters.
Right. Now, another
not
one
very
of the...
good with women too, because apparently he, you know, got into trouble for beating up women, girlfriends and whatnot.
Right. Now, another character is the Albanian John Alite. Alite, maybe I'm mispronouncing.
John, yeah, Johnny Alite. He was because he's Albanian. There's no way he was going to become in the mafia or La Cosa Nostra.
Right.
But he was a guy from Queens who you know, hung around sort of Woodhaven Boulevard area and Forest Park, and he says got tight with Junior Gotti through some, you know, drug dealing activity. Now Junior Gotti has denied that that he's had any sort of drug dealing activity. But, you know, Alite testified to that, and that's what he's told the FBI, and you sort of, that's the record you sort of with at that point. But Alite, you know, became a very important guy because he was heavy into drug dealing and by his own admission carried out murders. And he was aligned with the Gambino crime family. And he was so good at what he did that he was one of these associates like... you know, the guy Joe Watts, whom you may have heard about. He's one of these associates who, while not a member of organized crime, was big enough to have his own sort of crew of people.
Sure.
And he reported, of course, up the chain of command, but he was that well-respected in the crime family, at least for a period of time. But, you know, he had a love-hate relationship with Junior Gotti. And although they may have been tight for a while, in fact, I think it was Junior was the best man at his wedding. They ultimately sort of spun apart, and it's not clear exactly why. But I think Alite began to resent Junior in a number of ways for a number of reasons. And interesting character, because he knew a lot of the history of the mob, of the Gambino crime family, and yet another guy who, when the going got tough, and he was saddled with some. Throughout a prosecution, some heavy time for murders, he also became a government witness. So, you know, the old idea that, you know, people are going to be stand-up guys and not cooperate is, of course, you know, that's another myth, just like drug dealing.
Sure. Now, another character is Michael Scars Di Leonardo.
It's Di Leonardo.
Okay.
Mikey Scars got the name because he does have a scar on his face. Got in an accident. He was a very close friend of Junior Gotti and became a captain in the crime family. He was Italian, and he was another guy who bought lock, stock, and barrel the mob life. He wanted to be a gangster. He wanted to be, a captain. And somebody asked him once, well, you say you want to be a captain, did you mean in the army? And he said, no, in the mob. And that was his dream. You know, he loved the life. He loved the respect these wise guys got. And he emulated that, and that's what he aspired to, and that's what he became. In fact, he became a made member, so he testified, in the same ceremony in which John Gotti Jr. became a made member. So their die was cast together, in a sense, when they became made members. And that was a love-hate. It turned out to be a love-hate relationship because ultimately Di Leonardo became a government witness, you know, causing problems not only for Charles, but in a bigger way for John Gotti Jr., because he testified at, a number of his trials as well.
Certainly.
It's really an interesting cast of characters.
And he ended up not just being a person that's trying to save his own skin. Well, I mean, that's the main priority, but he was also well, not paid well, but he was paid as well as you probably could as a witness.
Yeah, I mean, he did very well. Of course, his main problem, what soured him, was that when he got arrested on a case, the crime family took away his income flow and his rackets. And that, he felt, that was unpardonable. And that really sort of soured him on the hierarchy of the Gambino crime family. Did involve Junior Gotti, because I think at that point he was in jail himself on a previous case. But he really soured on, you know, Peter Gotti and that whole crew.
Right.
It's all about money. You know, it's what it comes down to.
Sure.
That's what their existence is all about.
Now, one more, one interesting story before we get into what circumstances led to all of these people becoming and cooperating with the state and with the federal government in these indictments, because it doesn't happen right away. But one of the most important characters in this story is sort of a government official, Albert Gelb, or a court official. So tell us who Albert Gelb is.
Albert Gelb, it's a very interesting story. I'm glad you raised that. Albert Gelb was a court officer. He had the bad luck, as it turned out to be in a diner one night in the 1970s when Charlie happened to be in there. Charlie happened to be packing some guns. And by accident, Gelb, who was in there having a hamburger, saw that. And he said, "Well, that guy's got a gun. You know, I'm a peace officer. You know, court officers are peace officers, and they can have the power to make arrests." He said, "I got to find out if this is legit." So he confronted Charles downstairs in the diner and asked him if he was a cop, or why did he have those guns. And then, of course, ultimately they got into a fight. They're rolling around on the floor downstairs, and there was enough commotion that the staff of the restaurant called the cops. The cops came, arrested Charles. They found the guns, and they had a gun case against Charles. Well, that didn't do well for Charles, and witnesses said, threatened Gelb, you know, that this is not a good thing, you know, you don't know who you're messing with. And Gelb was under the perception through anonymous threats and whatever that he was going to be in for a rough time. Because he was going to testify against Charles. He was going to testify about the guns. Well, ultimately, to make a long sort of tortured story short, Albert Gelb was shot dead one night after he got off his shift in the courts. He was a court officer on the late night shift. And he got gunned down not far from his home in Queens. Suspicion immediately went to John Corniglia and Charles, because Charles, you know, had the pending case,
right.
And John was his brother. That's where the suspicion lay, and for the longest period of time, you know, people suspected that Charlie was behind it. That's the interesting thing about this case, though, is that when Charlie Corniglia went to trial for the Gelb murder, this was in 2009, that was the one aspect of the case that seemed the weakest to the jury, because there was one witness who testified about a shooter who didn't look anything like Charles. And Charles himself at various times told people, "Well, I stabbed him," and that he died because he was going against us, which is kind of ambiguous. You know, the standard of proof is, you know, wasn't really very strong,
right,
in this kind of thing. So Charlie was not found culpable of Albert Gelb's homicide. You know, some 30 years later, he went to trial on that. So that's an interesting aspect of the case. But, it's the homicide that really gave Charlie's story legs in the media. Because 30 years later, you know, the death of Albert Gelb, which is still remembered to this day in New York, was a charge against Charlie. And everybody was hoping, at least in law enforcement, was hoping that that would stick. The charge didn't stick.
Now, what mobster was with Charles and tried to persuade Charles to get lost before the cops came? Who was that?
Oh, there was a. I think it was Zaccaro. Peter Zaccaro. It was Peter Zaccaro. Peter Zaccaro was with him that night in the diner. Yeah, by chance, by the way. Peter Zaccaro was there for some other reason, and Charlie happened to come in. He was, you know, he'd just been to a wedding, and he, you know, sat down or walked up to their table and, you know, said, "How you doing?" So it was by chance. And Zaccaro tried to get him out of there after the fracas with Albert Kelp. But, it didn't matter because, you know, the cops tried to make a gun case. By the way, the gun case went away. It was dismissed for a number of reasons, and they did not make a gun case against Charlie. And that's the sort of irony of this. And Albert Kelp tried to do his job as he saw it as a peace officer, made a case, but ultimately the case gets thrown out, and for, you know, reasons that may be related to it, he's dead.
That's what I found especially interesting was the imagery you created by when Charles was in court for the Gelb murder, that comrades of Gelb, court officials, dressed in not in their uniforms but in suits,
right,
and just show of support, which I thought quite well captured in your book, that sort of force that
there was a constant show of force by the court officers and the Court Officers Association. Now, the very interesting element of this is that whoever killed Albert Gelb, and to this day we don't really know, the death really unsettled the mob. Because there are two anecdotes in the book I recount. One is how at a dinner on Staten Island, one of the court officer presidents of the association met the driver of Paul Castellano. This is a guy, Tommy Bellotti.
Right.
And Bellotti sought out Dennis Quirk, the court officer president, and he said, "Listen, you know, my boss had nothing to do with this. He wants you to know, you know, it wasn't a sanctioned thing," which is a pretty brazen thing to say.
Sure.
But he did say it. And then at the funeral of Albert Gelb, or right after the funeral, since his family was Jewish, they sat shiva. Two men came to the house, and they were sort of looked out of place. They were not Jewish, apparently, and they had a very sort of Italian look to them. And they asked to speak to Gelb's father. And they spoke to Gelb's father to say basically the same thing. You know, a mistake had been done. This was not supposed to happen, and we just want you to know. And then they walked away. And that was these two episodes. That shows clearly this was not something the mob wanted, because when Albert Gelb died, a lot of heat came on the mob, particularly
certainly,
the Gambino family.
Certainly.
And, the court officers to this day will always remember what happened. And, you know, it's an unsolved mystery, but to them, I think they really believe truly to this day that Charlie had something to do with it.
Right. Now, I know we're probably sort of jumping ahead a little bit, but failures did the prosecutors have before they finally get Charles on the stand with all these cooperating witnesses? Tell us about some of the failures that they had and why they had particular failure trying to prosecute Charles for all kinds of crimes.
Well, Charles, I mean, they had, I don't know if they had failures so much as he was like a lower priority. They had problems in some of the homicides they tried to pin on him. They had problems getting people in the community to talk about what happened, to cooperate or give evidence. They just, for years, that's the fact of life. You know, people in Howard Beach are afraid to talk about mob characters or cooperate in any way. It's kind of like, you know, it's the old, we didn't see anything kind of routine. So for years they had that problem. But what started to happen, of course, is that they got this domino effect of these various cooperators. You know, there was Zaccaro, Peter Zaccaro, Kevin McMahon, Johnny Alight, and you know a few other characters, Vincent Rossetti, who also testified. They gave important pieces of the puzzle later in the game that allowed them, because there was really no statute of limitation problem, that allowed the feds to make the case against Charles. But for the longest period, they didn't get any cooperation from people in the community until they finally, you know, got some people who were in deep trouble and saw cooperation as their only way out.
Now, the thing is, I thought it was important, and I had never read this before, and I'm probably going to mispronounce this, but I think it's the Lamine, and again, it's probably not a statute, but tell us what that really is, and it's the what kind of specific evidence could be introduced at trial. What was that? I'm jumping ahead a little bit.
In limine motion. Yeah, yeah. It's a you know, Latin term. You know, which has something to do for a limited purpose. What it is, and this often happens in mob cases, the federal government will say, we're going to introduce evidence of uncharged crimes, which may, we haven't indicted the guy for, but which we're going to try to bring up at trial for a variety of reasons. We're going to try to show membership in the crime family. We're going to try to show past, you know, opportunity and motive for carrying out similar crimes. We're going to try to show association. And I try to say, look, for instance, Joe Jones, you know, was involved in a homicide, which we didn't charge in this case, but the method in which he carried out is similar to what we've charged here. It's that kind of thing, and that allows them to bring in a lot of uncharged criminal allegations, which they didn't bring in the main case, but they're going to try to prove, in this case, to bolster their main case. It's kind of a, you know, second bite of the apple. Some people think it's unfair. Defendants always think it's unfair. And they try to get the government to limit what they can bring in. Sometimes they win, sometimes they don't. Most often they don't.
It's interesting and important to this case, though, because a lot of the witnesses could, not cross-reference, but could support sort of in this limited way some of the other information. So it becomes circumstantial, but becomes overwhelmingly circumstantial. It becomes almost inference. This happened, that happened, he did this. And the other thing I want to establish before we get into the trial itself is that the one thing that this judge, Jack Weinstein, limited when we get into this is the actual word, when we talked about Charles dissolving people in acid, and the one thing that the defense team did win on at some one point was that the judge thought it was overly prejudicial to be able to mention the actual word acid, but they got around it in other ways, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah. What happened was, you know, you're right, Weinstein did say, look, this acid stuff is, you know, we really can't get this in, can't have this come in this way. I don't want to have any reference to acid about killing people. But he would allow a reference, limited reference, to torture, because there was an allegation, one of these uncharged crime, that Charles used acid to torture people, particularly graphic episode that's described in the book. But and as things happen, you know, trials don't go perfectly. And what happened was that one of the witnesses, it may have been Zuccaro, it slipped out. Acid, the word acid came out, so they had to go through this whole rigmarole of instructing the jurors not to listen to that, kind of like unringing the bell. You know, it's out there, and you've got to say, you know, you got to sort of repair it somehow. And Weinstein was really, you know, perplexed by it, but he dealt with it, I guess, in his own way. But he did, for the most part, kept acid out of this case, but it was in the court papers, and there was some testimony about it, and that was the thing that, you know, allowed it to get in, and to some limited extent, particularly about the torture.
Mm-hmm.
That was what he would allow.
So that was very damaging. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it sat very well with the jury.
Now, of Vincent Rossetti Jr., Peter Zuccaro, John A. Light, and Michael DiLeonardo, all of these people were testifying that Charles Caniglia, or they were trying to, the federal government was trying to get him for 5 murders. So please tell us who testified first and what that particular witness testified to in terms of providing evidence of those, some of those or more of those 5 murders.
Well, as I recall, it was Di Leonardo who sort of set the table first. And he didn't really know firsthand about any homicides.
Right.
He had heard things indirectly, so he was used to, you know, talk a little bit about what he had heard. But again, the government had a problem in getting a lot of Di Leonardo's evidence in because of the very fact that it was all, a lot of it was hearsay, and he didn't have direct knowledge. And it was that kind of problem with Di Leonardo. You know, he really blocked the government about asking him, Di Leonardo, you know, what other people had said about Charles and his brother.
Right.
There was a problem. He could say he was a tough guy, you know, and that he was a loyal worker who did murders, but that's about as far as it could go. Ultimately, Di Leonardo, somewhat damaging, but not terribly damaging in my mind. The next one was Peter Zaccaro, who was really, I think, more damaging because he had, again, he knew about Charles' reputation. He said he killed good. That's what he testified to.
Yeah.
And, you know, unlike Di Leonardo, he could, who could only talk, you know, about what others had said, Zaccaro recounted what Charles had said to him. So there was no hearsay problem. And that was the De Bono murder, which I alluded to earlier, which Charles explored, you know, was supposedly involved in, and Zaccaro explored that. And that was a key murder, which was also, you know, in the case. And then, you know, there was other stuff, you know, chopping up cars, the drug business, all this Zaccaro, you know, was able to testify to. The De Bono thing, I think, was probably the most damaging thing that Zaccaro threw into the mix, as well as the armored car, some armored car heist and stuff
tell
like
us
that.
About the tell us about the De Bono murder and especially the JFK robbery, the airport robbery.
Well, De Bono, you know, Louis De Bono was a member of the Gambino family who had the misfortune of angering John Gotti Sr. by not showing up for a meeting when he wanted, when John Gotti wanted him to come. And for that, that was a cardinal sin, and that was what he was going to die for. And ultimately, as the testimony in the case showed, Gotti's son, although he denies this up, down, left, right, and center, the testimony, the witnesses claim that he put out the job to Charlie to put together some kind of hit team to take care of this. And it was Charlie, the witnesses testified, that put together a hit team involving himself, another character whose name escapes me, and Bobby Borriello. They were in on this, and they found Louis De Bono in the basement, parking his car in the basement parking lot of the World Trade Center, which was in existence at the time. This is 1990 or 1991. They got him. Kevin McMahon, I think, was a driver. And they, Charles got out, confronted De Bono, and the evidence showed that Charles pulled him over and, apparently fired some shots into De Bono. De Bono went down. He was a very corpulent, fat guy. He went down, and ultimately they had to, you know, push his legs into the car, and then they got out of there. And it was because of that, the De Bono murder, that Charlie got his wings, so to speak, in the Gambino crime family, became a made member. And that was when John Gotti Sr. looked upon him, you know, with some a sense of accomplishment. John Gotti Sr. made him, had him inducted.
Right.
And that's how, you know, that's how Charlie became in the mob. And then, it was through the killing of Louis de Bono.
And there was the another thing that has been fictionalized. I think I've seen it on Sopranos or Goodfellas, but at least they've taken this right from the pages, which I wanted to say, and I mentioned it to you as well. It's amazing how much stuff has been taken lock, stock, and barrel from these stories and not even fictionalized and thrown into Sopranos and Goodfellas and I'm sure some other stories as well. But
yeah, which incident strikes you?
Well, there was one where the guy was shot in the bar, and they picked that in both Goodfellas and Sopranos. But also the armored truck robbery where a guard dies, too, has been one of those movies as well. So it's just... The junior Gotti had the ankle bracelet. So it's there's a lot of parallels there anyway, where they take the same stories and just throw them in. So
yeah, and I'm not sure how much they knew at that time when they were writing the script, but it was pretty close to reality in some ways.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. You know.
Now, Charles Carnegiela, there was people, the government wanted these people to testify. Like you said, information, it really wasn't for charges specifically, but they wanted to have this information about the acid that they couldn't quite get in. But they wanted to show how ruthless, how much of a psychopathic killer that this Charles was, and then link him to these murders to make sure that they could put him away. So tell us some of the testimony about the body shop. We talked about the soup bones, you know, as he's learning how to dissolve these people in acid. But tell us about just some of the characteristics that set him apart from all these guys who are capable of killing, but that really set him apart and establish him as one of the most ruthless killers, even among Mafioso itself.
Well, what it was, you know, he didn't seem to have much of a control on his... anger management was not one of his strong points. And that's what, you know, he would be set off about a lot of things. And instead of talking to people and trying to, you know, assert himself that way, he'd lash out. And he would, you know, and we've seen all this in the testimony in the case, he would stab people. Or he would get involved in homicides and shoot them. The armored car heist. You know, in the setup, in the months before, in the weeks before that, you know, he would do casings of places, and this is what angered Zaccaro. He would be drunk. He'd go out on these early reconnaissance missions, and he'd be drunk, and he didn't know what to do. And Zaccaro said, "Look, I'm not going to have anything to do with this guy. You know, I don't know what's going to show up when I go out with him, whether it's going to be a drunk guy or a guy that's going to have his act together." And, right. That burns Zaccaro up. So Charlie, the major problem, you know, was that he really didn't have the kind of self-control that was going to make him go far politically in the mob. That kind of, the stabbings, the shootings, the incident in his junkyard where he got two young kids, and McMahon testified about this, and brought them in to find out who shot a gun at his brother's house and dropped acid through a turkey baster on their feet. That's really heavy, sadistic stuff. And he was all set to, you know, put the baster, McMahon said this, put the baster up their rectums. Before they finally spill the beans. I mean,
I thought that was amazing that it took them that long to give up their who it was. They said it was.
They went through some pain.
Yeah,
McMahon said, told us at the trial. But in the end, I think that image of the turkey baster, going up the backside was just too much, and they gave up whoever had the gun.
Yeah, Charles was very
small,
convinced.
It wasn't a small deal. It wasn't a big deal in terms of the firing of the gun, but. You know, in the world of the mob, that was a sign of disrespect to John Carnegiela, at whose house this happened. Mm-hmm. So,
Now the characters that are in that end up being cooperating witnesses: the Zaccaro, the John Aylett, Vincent Rossetti Jr., and Michael DiLeonardo. Now, what was their justification? I know there really isn't any justification. Like you say, they have a code, but nobody cares about the code. But just for interest's sake, what was some of the justification for some of these guys. We did talk about some of the people said, well, geez, this guy's supposed to be secretive. It's supposed to be a secretive organization, but the guy's a celebrity. Some people mm-hmm. were cut off financially, so they really had no means of income, so they justified it that way. Tell us mm-hmm. really their main justification for not going along with the tradition and cooperating, being cooperating witnesses. And in lots of cases, especially I thought interesting with Kevin McMahon, the guy that basically brought him in and took him under his wing as sort of adopted him, and he ends up testifying against him, trying to put him in prison for life. So,
well, there are a number of things here, but two or three come to mind. One is Charlie was not a diplomat, didn't take care of his friends, and that was part of the reason that McMahon soured on him. Charlie turned on McMahon, and McMahon says, you know, I don't know what's going to go on with this guy. I got to get away from him. Looks like he may try to kill me. And in the end, he really had no allegiance to him anymore. The other thing to keep in mind is that these guys basically deal from a position of self-interest. They all saw that there was going to be a period of time when they're going to look like they're going to spend, you know, 10, 20, perhaps the rest of their lives behind bars. Mm-hmm. If they could get some daylight and get a break on sentence from the government for cooperating against somebody who didn't mean anything more to them, they were going to do it. The thing with the mob is that, you know, these guys are all out for money, and money is really not much of an allegiance builder. You know, it really isn't. If that's what you're worried about, if you're not, you know, enamored with this old country Sicilian code of honor and respect and family and tradition, you know, all you got is money binding you to the next criminal, and that's not going to be a very deep alliance. Joe Messina, when he testified recently in the Bassiano trial, said it was asked, why are you doing this? And he says, well, I wanted to, you know, get something for my family so that they weren't impoverished, and I wanted to see perhaps some light at the end of the tunnel, meaning I'm facing life in jail. Maybe by cooperating, I'm going to be able to get out before I die. You know, and he was he's an old man, you know, he's late 60s, not greatest of health. So he wanted to do something to help himself. That's what it's about. That's really what it comes down to.
Now, given that, why didn't Charles Carnegie cooperate with the government?
Charlie bought into the theme. He didn't. He was an old school guy, older guy, not going anywhere in life. All he had was this concept of allegiance,
right.
And that's what he bought into early in life, and that's what he stayed with. He was given the opportunity. When they arrested him, they treated him with kid gloves in a sense, because they wanted him to try and cooperate, but he wasn't going to do it. And they asked him, and he just wasn't going to do it. He bought into the life, and that's the way he was going to die.
Do you think he got respect from, I mean, not that it matters, but did you think he got respect from some of the old school guys that were sitting in prison as a result?
Probably. And from some people on the street.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. In some ways, you know, he's like the old dinosaur. You know, there was, you know, and the story was that he'd cry, when reminiscing about the old days. But I think he realized, of course, that the old days of people who deserve loyalty were long gone. But there really wasn't much he could give up at that stage.
Right.
He was going to cooperate. He was going to cooperate. And some of the other guys in the family, maybe. But I don't think he wanted to do that. And he didn't. In the end, he didn't.
Right. And so how many of these cooperating witnesses ended up not doing any time at all and are free on the street now?
Well, I know Kevin McMahon got out.
He got paroled?
I think, he ultimately got his sentence, time served. So he's out. He may be in the witness protection program. Peter Zuccaro got sentenced recently, But he got a little bit of extra time, and he's also in the witness security program. Mm-hmm. Di Leonardo, I understand, is out. I don't think he's in the program. I think he testified that he's not in the program. A guy like Vincent Rossetti, he got time served. And he had some relatively minor crime. I think it was securities fraud that he was charged with. And he cooperated fairly early in his case. I think he got probation, or I think it was probation. So he's out. He's living, I think, someplace else. So a lot of these guys didn't get a break. Alight, I'm not sure about. I don't want to steer the wrong way, but I don't think he's out. Mm-hmm. If anything, I think he may have gotten some time,
right,
additional time. So he's not out. In fact, he may testify again in some other upcoming case.
And where is Junior Gotti right now?
He's a free man. He denies, you know, to this day, having a role in any of the homicides these cooperators tried to pin on him. He also denies any, you know, drug dealing activity. He's a free man. He went through four mistrials. Government dropped the last one, as you know. And he's trying to get his life together. He's supposedly making a movie about life with father, in a sense. But I'm not sure when that is going to, you know, get shot. But he's, you know, trying to get his life together. And, you know, he said he gave up the mob life a long time ago. Certainly, you know, enough that he had put together a defense that was, you know, his life was with the mob was done, and he was out of it. And it was, you know, convincing enough for some of the jurors, because you get a mistrial. The other thing was that somebody like Alight, the jurors, although he was convincing in Charles' trial, was not convincing in Junior Gotti's trial. He just seemed to have too much baggage. He seemed to have too much to gain by trying to pin everything that he testified to on Junior Gotti. So, in a sense, you know, Alight was a failure as a witness in Junior Gotti's case.
What did you, we're going to wrap up pretty soon here. We've got a couple minutes, but I wanted to know, you've worked, you've investigated this stuff for years and years, the mob, and you've written King of the Godfathers, and you've written extensively about mafioso life. What did you learn from writing Mob Killer and doing and looking at this Carnegula case? What, if anything, surprised you or you learned from this, even though you have vast experience studying these people?
Well, it reinforced, you know, what I had, you know, long suspected, that you know, this really is kind of an empty existence. You know, the bosses may make a lot of money, but for a lot of these guys like Charles, there's not much you get out of it in the end. You know, they have a term for them called brokester. You know, instead of gangsters, brokester, meaning you're broke, you don't have money.
Right.
The bosses do well. The underlings, the soldiers and the associates, they often don't do well. And what do you have in the end? You may have a prison sentence. You may be living hand to mouth after a prison sentence. You know, there's no retirement plan in the mob. And in a sense, the mafia eats its young. You know, if you're in it as a young guy, ultimately you're going to have a problem down the road, and it's going to probably eat you alive. And that seems to me, it's kind of like a real empty existence that they have. Yes, you may have the money, you may have trappings of power, you may have respect on the street, and for some people that's important. But the way you got to do it and go about getting it is going to, you know, really sort of hurt you in the end. That's what I've come away with. The government has some pretty potent weapons now against organized crime, and they are not afraid to use them.
Yeah, it seemed what part of your story was, too, is that these prosecutors were trying as hard as they could, even if trying to prosecute the one or have the trial down in Florida. And then Weinstein said, no, we can have it here in New York. But basically, they were adamant on getting these people. So it seems like, yeah, it's a very dead end in existence because the government's got all the time in the world and the resources. And that Trump card where, hey, do you want to spend the rest of your life in jail or cooperate? So it seems that they can break the backs of at least certain family members, and maybe they won't ever wipe out the mafia, probably never, but they sure make it tough for these people to continue in the old ways, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, it's not the mob our fathers knew, that's for sure.
No, absolutely. So, just in closing, what are you working on now? What's your next project, Tony?
Well, I'm toying with trying to follow through on Messino, because as you know, Messino testified, the first major mob boss to ever testify and become a government witness. So I'm trying to think about closing that loop with something. I'm also looking historically back into old Chinatown, which is rich with history and its own crime history, which is quite fascinating. At least I find it that way. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, you've written a great book here, Mob Killer. I'm hoping the audience found this as interesting as I did. And I want to thank you very much for coming on the little program and talking about this great book. So thank you very much, Tony, for this.
Well, thank you for the opportunity again, and it was a real pleasure. I find you a very conversant host who is prepped very well.
Well, you know what? I think the difference is I just read the books. I mean, I think that's my,
That's all you need sometimes, believe me.
Yeah.
And that it shows. It shows in the kind of questions that were coming out.
Well, thanks very much. I just want to tell our audience you've been listening to Anthony M. DiStefano, A Mob Killer, The Bloody Rampage of Charles Carnegie, Mafia Hitman. It's on the shelves, and it's probably an e-book as well, and Amazon, and available everywhere where great books are sold. So you have a great evening, Tony. Thank you very much for appearing on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the program True Murder, The Most Shocking Killers in True Crime History, and the authors that have written about them. Thank you. Good night.